WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Sting. The former bassist and lead singer of The Police is about to release his seventh solo album and embark on a world tour. We'll talk with him about growing up in an industrial town, teaching in a convent school, and playing the upright bass in a Dixieland jazz band. Also today, we talk with Greil Marcus about the 1948 recording that he says changed the course of popular music. Marcus has an essay about it in his new book, The Dustbin of History. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sting has released his first new studio album since his 1993 Ten Summoner's Tales. His world tour begins this week. We're going to hear some of his new CD, Mercury Falling, and talk with him about his life before and after he became known as Sting. He grew up, Gordon Sumner, in Newcastle, England. Sting first became famous in the late 70s as the lead vocalist and bass player of the British rock band The Police. Their hits included Roxanne and Every Breath You Take. Sting went on to a very successful solo career. He's also acted in the films Quadrophenia, Brimstone and Treacle, Stormy Monday, and The Adventures of Baron von Munchausen. And he played Mac Heath in a Broadway production of Threepenny Opera. He sings on the soundtrack of the current film Leaving Las Vegas. Before we talk, let's hear a track from his new CD, Mercury Falling. This is I'm So Happy I Can't Stop Crying.
Several weeks have passed now since she left me. She shows her face to ask me how I am. Says the kids are fine, that they miss me. Maybe I could come and babysit sometime. okay. I was worried about you. Can you forgive me? I hope that you'll be happy. I said, I'm so happy that I can't stop crying. I'm so happy I'm laughing through my tears.
Sting, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Tell us about the song we just heard, I'm So Happy I Can't Stop Crying, about how you wrote the lyric and the music for this one.
I actually wrote it as a different kind of song. It's kind of a rock song, really. And then I looked again at the lyrics and I realized, you know, it's about divorce and separation. And it's a country song. So I changed the arrangement. I put two in the bar on the bass and I got a pedal steel player in. I think there's a certain amount of irony about it being a country song, and yet it works. You know, I think the song is quite cynical in the beginning. He says, I'm so happy I can't stop crying, and he doesn't mean it. But I think by the end of the song, he's made some kind of journey of acceptance of the situation, or some kind of ability to face that situation, the courage to face the situation, and he actually means it by the end. So there's a journey being made, and I like that song, actually.
You try out several different styles that you haven't really done much before on the new CD. Do you see this as an experimental period for yourself?
No, I mean, I've always been interested in taking different genre and stretching them, to out of recognition almost. I think I'm not the sort of person who wants to just play one thing and then dig deep in that trench. I like to flit around, you know. I like to be mercurial in that sense, because I see music as very much a common language. I don't accept the sort of balkanization of music, you know, where you have very separate compartments of rock and roll, jazz, folk music. I really don't acknowledge those differences. I think it's all available to draw from.
I'd like to talk with you about your life and go back to your early days as a child. I know you grew up in Newcastle, England, an industrial town.
It's a seaport and various heavy industries. There's a coal field there, and it was an interesting town, though. It wasn't uninteresting. It certainly was. It was a Roman town. It was a medieval town. It was an industrial revolution town.
Was there much of much live music or any arts community there?
A huge music group there, mainly folk music and jazz, and every pub on every street corner has some kind of music going on in there. And that was the first sort of arena where I learned to play.
And how did you start singing?
How did I start singing? I always had a voice, actually. I would sing very sweetly in the choir at school. But when asked to sing on my own, it simply wasn't macho to be able to sing. So I would feign the voice of a crow, as all my peers did. But actually, when everybody was singing, I would have this angelic sort of voice. And I was aware that I could sing. I knew that I could sing. It was only when I began to play the guitar about the age of 8 or 9, and I think I began to sing about the age of 10.
Now, you went to Catholic school?
I did.
Did you ever go through a period of wanting to be a priest?
I did. I toyed with that idea, but rather perversely, I thought it was a good way of getting women.
Being a priest?
Yeah.
Why would you say that's a little perverse?
I think it is.
Why would you think that would be a good way of getting women?
Well,
a drummer,
thought,
I can understand. A
no,
priest,
I, just thought,
I don't get
I just
it.
Thought, you know, priests were always surrounded by women. Weren't the priests in your neighborhood surrounded by women? I thought you looked kind of attractive in your cassock, you know, and all those costumes. And I think the theatricality of the whole thing appealed to me. But the celibacy put me off.
Right, yeah. Right. So when did you wise up?
I wised up pretty quickly. I mean, I toyed with the idea, but it was only toying. A lot of my friends became monks, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Are they still?
I think so, yeah.
Now, how did you react to the discipline of Catholic school?
It was a fairly disciplined school. I was in a school with almost 3,000 boys. So to keep order, I think it was a fairly brutal regime. You weren't allowed to step out of line without being hit very hard. But I rebelled a little bit. I was caned a lot. We were caned with a big stick.
On your knuckles or your behind?
No, on the behind. And, you know, I look back on it now. I don't mind it. I wouldn't have my children go through that. But I don't think it did me any harm, to be honest with you.
Did you ever cry when you were caned?
You don't cry from pain. You cry from rage. After the third or fourth one, it's rage because it hurts.
That's kind of like crying because of pain, isn't it?
No, it's different. Crying from pain is different. Crying from rage is worse, actually.
So was it hard to sit after a caning?
You didn't want to sit after a caning, no.
Now, what was your school uniform like?
It was kind of maroon, a maroon jacket, grey trousers, grey shirt, a maroon tie, usually raggy. You know, raggy trousers and elbows that were worn.
How did you feel about having to wear a uniform?
It kind of marked you out from the rest of the kids you'd been brought up with, working class kids that you would play with in the street. When at the age of 11, you're whisked off to this school. I have to wear a uniform. It kind of separated you.
In a good way or a
no,
bad way?
No, a bad way.
Did it mean that you were probably wimpier or something?
No, it meant I was ostracized, really. That we were sort of told that we were the cream, you know, we were the top 10% of intelligence in the country, and I don't think it was true. But that kind of separated us from other people. I didn't like it. Mm-hmm. But I knew the value of school. I knew that I wanted to do as well as I could academically because that was a route out, a route away from where I was. I wasn't very happy where I was.
What didn't you like about where you were?
It seemed to be a sort of monochrome world, you know, it was kind of grey. I used to go to the movies with my brother on a Saturday and we'd see this technicolor world of Hollywood, you know, and I think, why isn't life like that here? So I wanted to escape to a technicolor world.
And when did you start thinking maybe music would be your way there?
Fairly early. I fantasized a lot as a child about making a living as a musician. I thought that was, and still do, I think it's the coolest way to make a living. Really, that was my only ambition, to pay the rent by making music. And that still is. I mean, being a star, being a celebrity, being famous is only a side effect of the initial ambition of wanting to be a musician.
It sounds like a pretty good music cue to me. Why don't we listen to something from your new record? My guest is Sting, and he has a new record called Mercury Falling. And why don't we listen to The Hounds of Winter, which is the opening track, and I think it really shows, especially in the lyric, the influence of folk ballads on your writing.
That could be true. Yeah, I sang a lot of folk ballads as a teenager, so they were burned into my brain.
Do you want to say anything else about this song?
It's really a song. It's about an older person than I am. It's about an old man who's facing the end of his life, you know. And I think it's a good rehearsal because I think there's something inevitable about growing old and facing death. And I think it's important to meditate on that. And my form of meditation is songwriting, really. So this is my meditation on death, really.
So this is The Hounds of Winter from Sting's new album, Mercury Falling.
Mercury falling, I rise from my bed. Collect my thoughts together. I have to hold my head. Seems that she's gone. Somehow I am pinned by the hounds of winter. They're howling in the wind. I walk through the day, my coat around my ears. I look for my companion. I have to dry my tears. It seems that she's gone, leaving me too soon. I'm as dark as December. I'm as cold as a man in the moon.
That's a new song written and performed by Sting from his new album, Mercury Falling. Well, let's get back to the story of Sting, the early years. So we had established that you went to Catholic school. And when, I guess it was after college, you taught poetry in a convent school for a while. Do I have that right?
I taught poetry. I taught soccer. I taught music. I qualified as an English teacher.
Uh-huh.
And I taught in school for about 2 years. I trained for 3 years and taught for two. I enjoyed teaching, actually. I enjoyed the hurly-burly of the classroom. I enjoyed standing up in front of a classroom and imparting things. I'm not sure that I taught anybody anything. I think that what happens in a classroom is learning, you know. I think some learning went on. When I enjoyed a subject, I could express enthusiasm for it, and therefore, hopefully, the kids got that enthusiasm in an infectious kind of way. But when I wasn't interested, I don't think I could teach anything.
So was this a convent school?
It was. It was run by nuns. I was the only man on the staff.
Oh, this is perfect. This is like your fantasy come true almost.
Well, not quite. Not quite, no.
No. Oh, well, it must be pretty strange to be a young man surrounded by women in the most non-sexual place that you could imagine.
Well, I got away with murder, actually. I was a musician at the time, and I was working very late at night in bands and sometimes having to go away for gigs. And so they just let me get away with it. You know, I was just said, look, I've got a gig tonight. Can I have the afternoon off? Or I got in late last night. Can I have the morning off?
So what was the band that you were moonlighting in?
I was in a lot of bands. I used to play in traditional jazz groups, actually, like Dixieland jazz groups.
And you played bass?
I played the bass, mainly with much older people than myself. And I learned jazz standards that way. I learned to read music that way. It was a strange education for a rock musician. I mean, most rock musicians learn Led Zeppelin songs, and I was learning 12th Street Rag.
So you were playing an upright bass?
I was playing an upright bass. But I was having a great time. I loved it. It didn't seem to be the route to rock stardom, though.
Is that what you wanted?
No. I wanted to be a muser. I wanted to be a musician. And this seemed to be the right way to go. And then I was in a big band. I played Count Basie arrangements, Neil Hefti arrangements, Duke Ellington arrangements. And I don't know, I think if I have a broad musical outlook now, it's because of the way I was educated musically, and that it wasn't just three chords in a garage, it was something else. Then I worked in theatres in the pit for musicals. I backed comedians, I backed striptease artists, I've just about done every musical job. I even played on a cruise ship.
So did you learn how to transpose and play in any key, depending on who you were backing?
Yeah, you'd learn how to busk. I mean, it's a phrase in England, you busk. They start a tune, and then they change the key at will, you know, and if they raise one finger, it's in the key of G. If they raise two, it's in the key of D. If they raise three fingers, it's in the key of A. If they put one finger down, it's in the key of F, and two fingers down is the key of B flat. I mean, you learn all these codes, and you learn all the standards. I once backed Tiny Tim, actually.
Really?
And he could sing every standard, hundreds and hundreds of standards, one after the other, and that was a hell of a job.
My guest is Sting, and he has a new album called Mercury Falling. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Sting, and he has a new album called Mercury Falling. So, now, what was the bridge between the work that you were doing and a rock and roll band?
I found a couple of people who were in this world with me, who were my age, and who had interest in playing jazz or rock and roll. And we formed a group in my hometown, and we used to play our own music in a pub. And we ended up with a residency. The band was called Last Exit. And I was the singer and the bass player, and we had a group that was very similar to the group I have at the moment, which was a four-piece group with drums, keyboards, bass, and guitar.
So how did you get an audition for The Police when the band was forming?
I was playing with this band called Last Exit at a local college, and a rock journalist that I knew who was local, he used to do local reviews of big bands, had just reviewed a band called Curved Air, and the drummer of Curved Air was Stuart Copeland. And after the gig, he said, why don't you come to this college and see this band Last Exit, because the singer is very interesting. He was talking about me. And I met Stuart afterwards, and, you know, we exchanged telephone numbers, and he said, if you're ever in London, call me. So, you know, about 3 months later, I decided that I was going to go to London and seek my fortune. Stuart's was the only telephone number I had. I called him up. He was living in a squat in Mayfair. You know what a squat is?
It's basically a place you move into that's like an abandoned...
Yeah, and you don't pay any rent. Anyway, I moved in there. We started this band. He called it The Police. It was his group. He'd written these songs, and it was the time of sort of punk, you know, the Sex Pistols and Johnny Rotten and all that. Mm-hmm. And we started the play in this old loft and got a few gigs, and I really didn't think it was going to happen. I didn't think the music was serious enough, but I stuck with it, and we ended up with a guitarist called Andy Summers, who was that was the final group that ended up as The Police, and we made a record called Roxanne. The record company heard it, they liked it, they signed it. It was a moderate hit, and then we came to America, and we came without a record company. Actually, we came just with our airfares and enough money to hire a bus. A little station wagon, actually. And we turned up at little gigs in places like Poughkeepsie and Syracuse, and three or four people would come to these gigs. And we built it up that way, slowly.
Roxanne really has a reggae influence. Had you been listening to a lot of reggae yourself?
I would contest that. A lot of people say it's reggae. It's not. It's a tango if you listen to it.
You think so?
It's a tango. I mean, I was
just listening to it again this morning and thinking, really reggae.
I was thinking that, I mean, I was very fond of Bob Marley at the time, so I was singing like Bob Marley. But the music actually is a tango.
Mm-hmm.
It's not reggae.
When you say you're singing like Bob Marley, were you trying to get some of his inflections also?
Yeah, absolutely. I was very influenced by Bob, and that's a clear influence. But the music itself isn't reggae.
Well, why don't we hear some of Roxanne, your first hit?
You'll hear it's a tango.
Okay. Listen closely. That's Sting with The Police, Roxanne, their first hit. Now, Roxanne was actually banned by the BBC, wasn't it? Because the lyrics were about prostitution?
Oh, I think they were looking for an excuse not to play it. I mean,
why would they need an excuse not to play it? I mean, why would they not want to play it?
Because so many records come out, they're dying for an excuse to say, well, we can't even consider this one. But we made a big thing out of that. They banned us, you know. I don't think it was because of the subject matter. It's quite benign, really.
Now, this was a period when The Police were getting started, when punk music, punk rock was also taking off. Did you want to be a part of that, or did you feel aesthetically distant from it?
Well, you know, I was a musician, I felt. You know, I'd paid my dues as a musician. And I felt punk was about people who just picked up guitars that month and made records. And the energy was something that I appreciated. Understood, and their anger was something that I really associated with, because I felt I'd been shut out of the music industry too. So I definitely felt a part of that. Well, the musical thing was not really my cup of tea, but I think it was a flag of convenience that we flew. I mean, I looked like I was part of the scene, even though I was a real musician, and so I just, you know, was expedient use of a fashion, if you like.
Now, how did it feel, too, to have a much kind of more pure, sweet voice in the era of punk, when people were actually shouting songs a lot, too?
Yeah, but they were only shouting because they couldn't sing. You know, I can do that as well. I think it's a choice that I make, actually.
Sting's new CD, Mercury Falling, will be released next week. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Sting. We're listening to one of his recordings from the soundtrack of Leaving Las Vegas. And Grille Marcus tells us the story behind a 1948 recording he says changed the course of pop music.
The very thought of you makes my heart sing like an April breeze on the wings of spring. And you appear in all your splendor. My one and only love. The shadows fall and spread their mystic charms in the hush of night while you're in my. I feel your lips so warm and tender. My one and only love. The touch of your hand is like heaven.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Sting. The internationally famous singer, songwriter, and bassist has a new solo album called Mercury Falling, and he starts a world tour this week. What surprised you most about rock and roll success?
That success and happiness weren't the same thing. If anything, they seem to be the opposite. I think some of the most successful periods in my life were the most unhappy. That was a good lesson to learn. It's a lesson that I take very seriously now. Success for me is to be happy and sane, not necessarily have millions of records sold or millions of Grammy nominations or whatever. That's not particularly wonderful. It's nice, but it's not happiness.
Remember you said as a kid you went to the movies and you wished you could live in that kind of Technicolor world?
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever end up feeling like you inhabited that kind of Technicolor world?
I don't remember.
Right. Okay. Too distracted by...
I was distracted. I mean, I'm glad I was quite old. I was 25 or 26 when all of this was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if I'd been any younger, I'd probably been dead. But I managed to survive it, and I'm here today to tell the tale. But it was pretty wild. I mean, it was pretty meteoric. I mean, it was just everything is thrown at you, and nothing is encouraging you to grow up or be responsible.
It always seems like such a dangerous formula for somebody who's young.
I think it is. And, you know, you can be 19 and be on top of the world, and then the next year you're at the bottom of the heap, and that's an impossible tragedy. You can't really recover from that.
When the police broke up and you went solo, did you have an idea right away of the kind of backing that you wanted for yourself? I mean, the police had a much more, like, rock edge than your solo work did.
I really wanted to start again. I think the police had reached a peak. You know, we played Shea Stadium, and I could see the police just playing Shea Stadium for the rest of their careers, you know, just repeating the same kind of success, pressing the same button, and I was frankly bored by that idea. I wanted the feeling of starting again. I wanted to go back to the beginning. I mean, of course, there was a certain amount of momentum attached to being in a big group like the police, and people would be curious about whatever I came up with next. So I had that advantage. But also, I think people have a resistance to change, and there was a certain amount of resistance to me not being in the police, particularly when I was joined by people who would normally play jazz, like Branford Marcellus or Kenny Kirkland. And, I mean, my intention wasn't to play jazz at all. My intention was to use the feel of jazz, the sound of jazz, but to play very arranged pop music.
Mm-hmm.
And there was resistance to that, although it was a big success. But it certainly wasn't a given. But I enjoyed that challenge, too.
Well, I'd like to pause here from our conversation and ask you to choose something from your new CD. I've been doing the choosing.
Okay.
Let me give you a turn.
There's a song, I think it's the second song on the album. It's called I Hung My Head. It's written in 9/8 time. I wrote this riff in 9/8, and it reminded me of the gait of a galloping horse. It's kind of an awkward gait. And it's a bar of 5 followed by a bar of 4. And that idea of the horse galloping gave me this idea of a sort of Western scenario. It's the song is about an accidental shooting and a trial and a hanging. And I'm rather fond of it.
The Memphis Horns are on this track. They backed Otis Redding. How did you decide to use them?
Well, they didn't just back Otis Redding, you know. You name your favorite 20
record,
soul songs, and they played on all of them. They played with Sam and Dave. They played with Al Green. They played with Otis. They played with everybody. And they have a certain authentic sound. And when they played on my record, I was thrilled that, first of all, I was thrilled they agreed to. And as soon as they started playing, there was that authentic Memphis sound. And I was really honored that they played on the record.
So here's a new song by Sting called I Hung My Head from his new album, Mercury Falling. Sting from his new album, Mercury Falling. Now, you once told a reporter that you used to believe you had to be destructive in order to be creative. I'd like you to expand on that and tell us how you got over that thinking.
Well, I don't think this is unique to my thinking. I think a lot of artists have the same idea that you have to be suffering in a garret somewhere or be going through some kind of emotional crisis in order to be creative. And it works to a certain extent, But I just made a choice in my life a few years ago when I was, you know, thinking about manufacturing another crisis so I could be creative. And I just stopped myself short and said, wait a minute, is this gonna fly? Do I have to do this for the rest of my life? Can't I just be happy? Can't I just have a stable home life and make music without going through this nonsense? And that's what I've done for the past 7 years almost, that I'm a happy man, actually. I'm very content, if you like. And I've managed to make music that's not, I don't think it's complacent or smug. I think there's still a lot of pain in it because I have a lot of memories. But I don't want to live my life like that anymore.
You've had a parallel acting career, which began, I think, with Quadrophenia. Was that your first film?
That was the second film I made. But again, I fell into films by accident. I had no ambition to be an actor. I never trained as an actor. I was never even in a school play. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time with the right haircut.
Of the films of yours that I've seen, my favorite performance is in Stormy Weather. Stormy Monday. Which Mike Figgis directed, who also directed Leaving Las Vegas. And you're a kind of corrupt, pretty mean club owner.
Oh, I thought I was rather nice, actually. Yeah, yeah. Well, that was set in Newcastle, which is the hometown
That's where you grew up.
Of both Mike Figgis and myself. And
did that have anything to do with you meeting?
Oh, absolutely. He wanted someone who knew that scene. That club scene was very similar to my musical background. I used to play in clubs like that. And so he knew that and cast me because of that. And I actually played my brother in that. My brother owns a club in Newcastle.
Really?
Yeah.
What kind of music does he have?
He has, you know, jazz and rock and roll and folk music.
Gee, does he impose on you to to come and play?
No, he doesn't. But he recognized himself in the movie, which is quite funny.
My guest is Sting. His new CD is called Mercury Falling. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sting. He has a new CD called Mercury Falling. You've said that, you know, you don't want your music to have to come from, you know, misery and unhappiness, that you want to lead a decent life and write good music at the same time. What kind of environment have you created for yourself, for your home?
Well, I live in a very old house. It's about 450 years old in England. And it's a beautiful house. It's a beautiful environment. I share it with my wife and children and about 7 dogs and about 8 or 9 cats, a few horses and cattle, sheep, bees, ducks, you name it. It's like a Noah's Ark, actually. But I actually make music in the house. I record in the dining room with the children around, with the dogs around. And I much prefer that to the sort of sterile studio environment that records are normally made in.
So is your new record made in your house?
Yeah.
In the dining room?
Yeah, you can hear the kitchen noises if you listen very carefully.
I didn't notice that.
Dogs barking, log fires crackling.
Not really.
You can.
Really?
Aeroplanes going overhead.
What'd your record company say about that?
Well, they haven't complained yet.
Do you ever play traditional jazz anymore?
I'd love to. It's something I actually miss. I miss Sunday lunchtimes in the pubs playing Beale Street Blues and Tiger Rag, you know.
What do you listen to?
I don't listen to very much music, to be honest with you. I prefer silence. I've got enough music going on in my head, and if I want music, I can play it. But I don't listen to music to relax. Music it can be a form of torture, you know, in that you're almost forced to analyze it constantly. If you hear music by accident, you know, say, well, what key is that in? What's that chord? How are they doing that? What's that instrument? What's the harmony here? Not, wow, this is really relaxing.
So that's what happens to you when you hear music?
Yeah, I don't sit back on the sofa and listen to music. Huh. It's not my bag.
Well, let's close with another song from your new CD, Mercury Falling. One of the songs on here is going to be the single, or already is the single, and it's called "Let Your Soul Be Your Pilot." No, who chooses which is going to be the single? Is this you or your record company?
I think I play the whole album to the record company, and I'm pretty good at engaging genuine enthusiasm from fake enthusiasm, and I can see what's making them excited, and I think this song got them excited more than any other. As a first crack at the single market, so I just went with it. I mean, I used to know very clearly what was a hit. Now I don't. I haven't the faintest idea. But I like the song, and so I went with their decision.
Tell us something about writing it.
It's a fairly generic harmonic sequence. You know, it's a major chord followed by a relative minor. I've used this trick before, and Every Breath You Take, and a million other songs have been written with this chord sequence, including Stand By Me and Oh Carol, I think. But I just sat at the piano and I thought, let's give this one another go. So, I played G and then E minor, and then this sort of gospel-y kind of idea came into my head, and this line, "Let your soul be your pilot," kind of insinuated its way. And I ended up with this sort of gospel-sounding song, and I hope you like it.
Well, I do. Let's hear Sting from his new album, Mercury Falling. And thank you so much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
Let your soul be your pilot. Let your soul guide you.
Sting's new CD, Mercury Falling, will be released next week. Coming up, the story behind a record that helped set rock and roll in motion. This is Fresh Air. In his new collection of essays, The Dustbin of History, Greil Marcus devotes a chapter to one record, a record he thinks changed the course of pop music. That record, It's Too Soon to Know, features the Orioles, perhaps the first doo-wop group. We asked Marcus to play the record and to tell us the story behind it. Marcus, who is also the author of the classic rock and roll book Mystery Train, says the Orioles record It's Too Soon to Know was a shock, like Elvis's That's All Right or Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit.
This record came out in 1948, and it was a time when there was no concept of rhythm and blues. The term rock and roll referred to sex. It wasn't about music. And here came a song that, unlike the records you just mentioned, was quiet. It was more than quiet. It was like a ghost whispering. It was ethereal. It seemed to come out of nowhere. It didn't seem to make any sense. And yet it was so full of emotion. It was so full of yearning and passion that it seemed to disassemble whatever people brought to it. Maybe you were in a bad mood. Maybe you were expecting the radio to play your current favorite song, Open the Door, Richard, which is a sort of corny hit of that moment. Whatever was going on, this wasn't what you expected. And yet it was so beautiful and so different that people turned their head and people began to talk about it and say, what is that? Why? What's this doing here on my radio? At the same time, nobody needed to be prepared for it, so people responded directly. And without discussing it, without analyzing it, people began, I think, to demand the same kind of sincerity, the same kind of depth, the same kind of passion out of a lot of things in their lives, and one of those being the culture they were living in.
Why don't we hear the record? This is the Orioles, It's Too Soon to Know.
Does she love me? It's too soon to know. Can I believe it when she tells me so? Is she fooling? Is it all a game? Am I the fire or just another flame? Oh, once I did love would break my heart. She may be just acting and playing the part. If she don't love me, let her tell me so. I can't hold her. If she wants to go, though I'll cry when she's gone, I won't die, I'll live on. If it's so, it's too soon, way too soon.
One of the interesting things about this song is the person who wrote it. Tell us about her and why you became so fixated on getting her story.
I've been fascinated by the Orioles' It's Too Soon to Know for many years, without any particular reason for it, without thinking about why. I collected articles about it, none of which ever said very much. I knew it was written by someone named Deborah Chesler. As time went on, I found out she was a young Jewish woman in Baltimore, and the vocal group, the Orioles, was black. I thought that was interesting, and I thought, this woman has got to have a great story to tell. What is a white woman, a Jewish woman, doing with five black men in Baltimore in the 40s, when Baltimore was a segregated city, when blacks and whites were not together in any manner, was a southern town in that way? I didn't know if she was still alive. It took me a long time to track her down. I arranged to go to Miami, where she lives, to talk to her. And she is this feisty, strong, funny woman who did a remarkable thing for a period of her life. She fought off a disastrous marriage. She wrote a song and followed it with many other songs that was unlike anything anyone had heard. She toured all of the East Coast of America, all through the South, for years with five black men. Not exactly something that was done at that time. And as far as she was concerned, she was simply trying to make a living. And yet the more we talked, the more it was clear that it wasn't just in her mind, it wasn't just her own little world that turned when this record began playing. And I think she knew that.
What was her relationship to the Orioles? Was she managing them?
She managed them. She wrote their songs, not all of their songs, but many of their songs. She arranged records with them. She was their tour manager. She was their business manager. She was, as Sonny Till, the lead singer of the Orioles, said in 1981, which was right when he died, just before he died, he said, "You were like our sister to us, and we loved you." And when I heard that, I thought, I have got to tell this story. You don't hear that in pop music. You don't hear that in popular culture, when someone who once had fame and once had riches and now has lost it all looks back. These people don't look back with affection and love. They look back with resentment and a feeling of being cheated. And yet that wasn't what this story was about. I had to tell it.
You know what I miss? In the early days of doo-wop, a lot of the songs were standards that the doo-wop groups either did as their A-side or often as their B-side, you know, just to round out the record. There wasn't a big library of, you know, original doo-wop and rhythm and blues songs, so people fell back on jazz and pop standards. And you got a lot of really interesting reinterpretations of those songs. I mean, the Orioles, for instance, did "I Cover the Waterfront."
One of their absolute favorites.
Oh, really?
Oh, they love that song.
Do you miss those days? I mean, I do. Because I have such an affection for those, you know, jazz and pop standards, and you know, people don't cover them anymore. I mean, not rock and rhythm and blues people.
No, I can't say that I do. I grew up in a household where those songs were played all the time in their 30s and 40s incarnation by my parents, and so I was thrilled to hear something that was a complete contradiction of that, or felt like it, whether it was or not. So I don't miss that, but I can understand what you're talking about, because here were songs with marvelous melodies, with all kinds of untapped possibilities for vocal harmonies. It's kind of like jazz musicians in the 50s with My Funny Valentine. I mean, they knew that song was inexhaustible. There was no way you were going to get to the end of those melodies. And if you couldn't do something new with that, well, you just weren't worth the name jazz. And there's a quality of that, of people not necessarily trying to top each other, but to find something new in a piece of music that everyone thinks they already know. That's very exciting.
Gurriel Marcus's essay about Deborah Chesler and her song "It's Too Soon to Know" is included in his new book, The Dustbin of History. Here's the Orioles' recording of "I Cover the Waterfront."
I cover the waterfront. I'm watching to see if the one I love must soon come back to me. I cover the waterfront. I'm in search of my love, and I am covered by a starry sky above. Now, when there am I, patiently waiting, hoping and longing, well, how I did. I cover the waterfront.
The Orioles recording of I Cover the Waterfront. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audrey Bentham, Joyce Lieberman, and Al Banks. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ellen, too, directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.